The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
How did an elephant get into your novel?
I don't know. It's in the middle of the book. It's kind of the bridge that holds the front end and the back end together. How it got there, I don't know. It got away from a circus, and it went across the desert, and there's this really harsh landscape. But how it got there, that's a great question. I don't know. But once it got there, I really enjoyed having it there.
It just appeared in your mind one day?
It must have. It must have. I don't know how that elephant got there.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. Rick Bass is my guest this time, and we're talking about his new novel titled All the Land to Hold Us. So we'll come back to that elephant in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about Oprah. You and your novel are currently featured at Oprah.com. In fact, you're one of seven authors in their summer reading section with the subheading, Writing Tips, Signs You Are Meant to Be a Writer. And here's what you supposedly said about that. After reading a Jim Harrison novella, Legends of the Fall, you said, quote, I don't know why, but after reading that novella, I wasn't content to simply remain a reader. Something changed, and it had to do with the great characterizations and incredibly specific and painterly lush descriptions of landscape, particularly wild country. Do you remember talking with anybody at Oprah.com?
I do not. I have a bad memory, but I think I might have remembered that. I have no recollection. The words attributed to me do sound familiar, but I can't remember in what context or to whom I spoke them.
I'm always curious about whether the people who put these things together are actually talking to the writer or they're just lifting things from somewhere else on the web.
I think this may be the latter.
Good publicity, though. There's a picture of the book there.
It's a beautiful cover. Yeah, I was really thrilled with the cover.
Love the elephant.
Yeah.
Well, like a lot of people, I came to your work, to your writing, through your nonfiction, through your environmental writing. And I was a little bit wary of you as a fiction writer, but now I love your fiction, and here's why. It's because when I read your novels and your short stories, I feel like your words are really stretching the boundaries of perception, that you were pushing really hard at those boundaries when you wrote the words, and so now I'm pulled into something new while I'm reading. And I don't mean to imply that your stories are esoteric, because that's not the way I see them. But it seems to me that you work very hard, or you accomplish it, whether you're working hard at it or not, at writing the beauty of the land into your prose. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. Thank you. That's kind and accurate. Yeah, no, that is a goal. So I'm glad that's how you read it. There's a thing that you do. I used to be an oil and gas geologist, and there's a thing you do when you're looking for oil and gas, you know, below the surface where you don't have many clues. And so you're really pretty attuned. You're searching. You're searching pretty hard and pretty deep. Likewise, as a hunter, you go off into the woods and you're wired up pretty tight, looking for what it is you're looking for. You're smelling the forest, scenting it. You're listening. You're really hyper aware of what every little current of wind is doing, so you'll stay hidden. And those kinds of, I think, activities wire the mind to give it more of a disposition toward that condition you're talking about, where you try and stretch or attenuate or fill a sentence with kind of a maximum senses and perceptions. Yeah,
it's almost like I could imagine that you're sitting there writing and you're just seeing this movie in your head.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times, and the older I get, the more it's this way for me. It's like seeing a painting. You know, a lot of writers talk about hearing the sentences or hearing the words in their mind, but to me it's more like colors and shapes. And, you know, sometimes you just see it so lusciously. You just want, it's like a painting that you want to lick. You want to lick the, like it's frosting or something off of the canvas. It is a different perception or perspective, perception and perspective. It's interesting that you describe it that way. I certainly don't think about it, but it is what's in me when I'm working. Yeah, it's a goal, but I don't think of it that way.
There's a lake in this story. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Juan Cardona Lake?
Yes, uh-huh.
Which has been fought over by natives and invaders in various ways for a long time and for many reasons. Tell us about that lake, the place, and why it's important in the story.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to that idea of history, you know, deep history, the strata or bones of history. It's interesting to me as a geologist how landforms, whether sedimentary or otherwise, kind of replicate themselves across, you know, the underlying original condition. And you know, the old saying that history repeats itself. It's interesting to me the same way that human stories often tend to repeat themselves within individuals and then even beyond individuals, within across generations and across a culture. So the lake was an attractant, you know, a gathering place, a central node that drew humans and non-humans to it. And then their stories played out there around the perimeter of that lake and often in similar patterns, sometimes similar elements, but in similar patterns, again, of hunger in a land of extreme deprivation, going after whatever it was that they sought, treasure or relationships or resources, whatever. And the repetition or replication of story shape around one central place, one central node, you know, was kind of a structure here in the book.
Salt is also a big deal.
I love that idea of you know, having an excess of something that's so necessary and yet so elemental. Yeah, salt's a good one. It's kind of an interesting mineral.
There were characters in the book who were making their living by harvesting the
digging
salt.
It up.
Is that
yeah.
what you call it?
yeah.
And they would sell it to ranchers and...
I love that idea of selling, trying to make a living, selling something that's so common and abundant. What a hard gig that would be, where really you just have to deal in volume. And how does that wire the mind to be working at just sheer grinded out grunt work, volume rather than quality, you know, artisanship? It's, you know, they don't call it working in the salt mines for nothing. I mean, it's a great metaphor for kind of a suck life.
There was greed associated with the salt too, though.
There was greed, but in addition to greed, there was also just kind of bottomless hunger, which is maybe, you know, just a cousin of greed, not necessarily the same thing. It might be, I think almost a bottomless hunger being, having a kind of quality of terror to it, whereas greed is almost... despite it being such an unattractive quality, is more of a positive reaching for something, reaching for more of something, gluttony. But whereas a lot of the hunger, you know, that bottomless hunger stuff is like a negative. There's not enough. They need more. The same condition, but maybe slightly different motivations.
Hmm. You also portrayed that in the oil men, the roughnecks that were out there, and they couldn't seem to get enough of anything.
Yeah. The way the brain gets wired by one's daily activities is really interesting to me, and the way that sets up patterns where if you know they got used to reaching for more and more oil, and then they got used to reaching for more and more of everything else too.
Well, we usually link big corporations. This book is about land, and we usually link big corporations with activities that harm the land. I'm not saying there aren't a lot of people in this book, but there's a lot of land in this book as well. All the land that holds us tells the stories of individuals. Was it your intention with this book to bring individual accountability into focus?
I'm not sure what you mean by accountability. I don't think so. I don't. In what sense do you mean?
Showing how the actions of individuals can result in damage or changes.
Not to the landscape. No, it was just a harsh, big landscape. But you know, the accountability of individuals to one another was you know, was certainly as with any work of fiction, is kind of the primary schematic, I suppose. You know, how people interact with each other and how they're responsible for their actions and accountable for those actions in the relationships. I guess when I started this book, I was picturing, you know, the cast of characters, you know, 12 or 20 or however many of them there are, stippled across time and across this immense landscape where a resource, water, is in extreme scarcity. And, you know, under the pressure of deprivation or diminishment of one thing, something valuable, how do those characters act as that pressure increases? And the thing in need is not always water in the novel. Sometimes it's love, sometimes it's respect, sometimes it's space, sometimes it's water, sometimes it's oil. Everybody in the novel needs and wants something quite desperately, and some get it, some don't. The ones who do get what they need, they go after it, and it's a long, hard journey. Yeah, on a big landscape. But no, I was not in any way attempting to, you know, illuminate or even portray accountability for one's relationship to the land. In my mind, the characters were so isolated and individualistic against that, again, that vast landscape, that their scratchings at the surface were pretty insignificant, you know, to the land itself. The damages that they did to one another, you know, were where the accountability was, and the support that they gave one another is where the accountability or connections were.
You must have done a lot of research for this book, because you have treasure hunters of all kinds tromping through the book, and it takes place in the 1500s and the 1800s in small patches, and then mostly in the 1930s and the 1960s. But there's so much history in there. There's so much accuracy.
I did do a lot of research, which is definitely not my wheelhouse. I don't care for it. I prefer to traffic in the imagination as much as possible. But you can't grow up in Texas and not, you know, be versed deeply in Texas history. They are, you know, very proud of the history. And there's a lot of strata of history that precedes, you know, the white colonists. So it's definitely a garden for history.
What was it that initially prompted you to write this story? What was it that you wanted to explore?
It was so long ago when I started it, I honestly can't remember. I started this way, way back. I started this novel pretty much the week after I finished my first novel. And, you know, that was in 97 or 98. I guess it would have been 97. And so I've been working on this on and off in various drafts ever since. What was it that prompted me? I think I wanted to write a novel set in Texas, again, for that, you know, the point of extremely interesting history. And, you know, while I was working on this one, I did this little tiny one called The Diezmo, kind of in the middle of things, that is also a historical novel set in Texas. That was more a response to the Gulf War, then, you know, an allegory. It was kind of a strange little book. But this was, you know, big, fat, old-fashioned, take-your-time novel. And you know, I had finished one that was set in Montana, and I thought, okay, I'm going to try another one and set it in Texas.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Rick Bass about his novel titled All the Land to Hold Us. When we return, he'll read a passage from the book in which an elephant shows up in West Texas. Stay with us. ¶¶ Well, let's hear something from the book. Back to that elephant. This is a passage where Marie sees the elephant for the first time.
Yeah. So in this section that I'm going to read, Marie is the long-suffering wife of the salt cutter, who's the salt cutter's, I won't say passion, all he has in his life is just to haul out great amounts of salt, and he's kind of become one-dimensional through the repetition and regularity of that arduous task. And Marie's just kind of treading water, you know, so to speak, just out there in this really grim landscape with not a lot going on. And
I'm not sure how she feels about her husband anymore.
Well, I think she's starting to get pretty sure about it, actually. Yeah, yeah. Kind of beyond transition of that, and is pretty much starting to figure some things out. And then one night, this elephant comes through her yard. A strange and powerful landscape summons strange and powerful happenings, just as beauty seems to summon beauty, or harshness beckons to harshness. One night, Marie was awakened from her sleep, if her alternating bouts of terror and stupor could be called that. Not to the sound of sand or bird or coyote, but to what seemed at first to be a complete absence of sound, as if the entire world around her had paused in order to listen to something so wonderful and unusual that it caught for a few moments even the world's uncaring attention. Gradually, as her senses readjusted to the different pace of the silence, Marie realized that it was not a complete soundlessness she was hearing, but rather the distilled purity of one sound, a gigantic and strangely rhythmic thrashing out in the lake, huffings and suck-hole gaspings, spews and sputters, enormous, lonely splashings unattended by any other sound. Marie rose from her bed and went out onto the porch, damp in her nightgown. It was October, and there was enough of a breeze from the north to cool her. She wrapped her arms around herself, and in the night and the just-awakened grogginess of things, she forgot for a moment who and what she had become and believed herself to be a young girl again. The moon was bright upon the lake. She listened harder as the sound separated itself from the non-sound and as her sleep separated from waking. There was an enormous hump-shaped animal writhing and lunging out in the lake, powering its way through the moon-bright floating bog of salt. Marie gripped a front porch post for support, trying in that grip to pull herself up from the well of sleep and fully into the land of waking so that the monster's image might disappear. But the sight would not go away. Disbelieving, she walked out barefoot into the salt-packed hardpan yard, the surface of it cool and smooth and worn beneath her feet, and dared to look closer and saw that her initial dream had been correct, that there was an elephant in the lake, with immense flapping ears and long shining tusks like scimitars and a wild waving trunk. The exertions of the animal were sending shallow waves splashing up onto the shore. Marie imagined instantly, in that first moment of knowing for certain what the creature was, that she could see, even across the distance, that one bright, wet, shining eye of the animal, filled with both terror and resolve, as well as a bottomless loneliness, and that the eye of the elephant was fixed upon her, even in the midst of the animal's terrific struggles. And in that moment, amidst such a surreal vision, Marie felt more grounded, sane, and hopeful than she had in years. Like a sleepwalker, she walked down to the lake shore to offer silent encouragement to the lunging animal, being careful not to break contact with what she perceived to be the desperate creature's drowning, thrashing gaze held fixedly upon her own. At the lake, she crouched on her haunches and watched, unblinking and hypnotized, and silently urged the elephant on. Behind the elephant lay a wake of furrowed salt, a wandering path as jagged as if sawed through chunks of ice. The elephant had already cut a great furrow across the lake, and Marie wondered what might have led it to enter the lake in the first place. Strangely, she did not wonder where the elephant had come from. Already, it seemed to fit. There was no telling how long it had been floundering, nor for how long the sound of its labors had entered into Marie's restless sleep. From time to time the elephant would, despite its panicked frenzy, pause and rest, gathering its breath and energy, though during such cessations it would begin to sink slowly, drawn down into the summoning mire. When this happened, the elephant leaned over on one side to keep from sinking farther, and the great trunk would wag and loll plaintively, as if the animal was giving up. And it would be all that Marie could do to keep from rolling up her nightgown and wading out into the lake herself to try to somehow help the creature. "Hold on," she whispered into the great silence. "Hold on." And soon enough, as if heeding her pleas, the elephant would roll back over, his eye fixed once more upon hers, she was certain of it, and would labor on as if in harness and pulling the whole of the world behind him. Marie sat hunkered there for 2 hours watching the struggle, the elephant's rest growing longer and longer, and, did she imagine it, a shine seemed to be leaving the eye. But finally the creature dragged itself up onto the farther shore, crawling out on bent knees, and only then uttering, for the first time all evening, one weak and spent trumpeting. Not a call of victory, but more a feeble, tentative inquiry as to the possibility of others of the elephant's kind who might be hiding out in the dunes or cached just a short distance farther into the darkness. Marie had expected the elephant to take advantage of the firmer ground by rolling over on his side and resting once more. And if he had, she was prepared to go to him, to haul buckets of water and bathe the crust of glittering salt from his hide. At the far end of the lake, standing beneath the bright moon, he looked bejeweled. But she was surprised to see that he wasted no time upon his emergence. He paused only briefly, having given his lone trumpet, and then strode off toward the dunes, lake water still trailing from his thick legs in sheets. Every now and again he would punch through the crust of the shoreline and stumble and sink to a knee. But each time he pulled free and continued on his way, traveling in such a straight line that Marie had no doubt he knew precisely where he was going, even if he never had been here before. And for this, too, she found that she loved him. Still in her nightgown, she followed him for nearly a mile, walking along the lake shore until she came to the intersection of where he had crawled out and gone off into the dunes. She followed him into the dunes, tracking his cratered prints, which were spaced so far apart that it took 3 of her steps to travel the same distance. She hurried along his trail, the sand still wet from his passage and caking to her bare feet. With each dune she climbed, it seemed to her he might be just on the other side, big as a barn and striding magnificently, head held high, tusk shining bright, or that he might even be holed up in a trough, resting, so that, descending that final dune, she would be free to walk up to him and put her hand on his leathery hide, to hold her hand out to his snuffling trunk for him to take her scent, to perhaps even climb the trunk as she had seen children do in pictures, passing between the long ivory swords that would act like bars, protecting her from anything below, and to ride upon his hairy back then, on through the dunes and out of the desert. Riding for a while, seeing all the sights from a newer, slightly higher perspective, as when she was up on the roof of her cabin and then napping in the heat of the day, taking her gown off and ripping it to fashion into a crude and flapping tent beneath which she could seek shelter from the sun, while the fanning of his enormous ears sent a slight cooling breeze her way, and as he kept traveling, leaving the lake and the desert and eventually all of Texas so far behind. Each dune scaled, however, brought her nothing. The sand in his tracks was still wet, and the scent of the lake upon him was still rank and strong, but when she got to the top of the dune and looked down, he was not in the trough below, nor was she able to see him anywhere in the distance. And she would stand there atop the dune, breathing hard, her thighs and calves burning, watching in the dimming moonlight, dawn not too distant now, the crest beyond her, and hoping that on one of those distant sand ridges she would see the dark shape of the elephant climbing his own dune and then disappearing over the back side, so that she would know the distance required to catch up with him. It was an awful feeling, like being lost, hoping that he was merely in one of the troughs while she was on a crest, and vice versa. Her chase of him becoming in that manner like the notes of a song, a teasing, carnival-like melody. In the waiting, there was rest, but there was also the taunting knowledge that the elephant might already be just over the horizon, and that rather than her gaining on him and closing the distance, he was moving ever farther away. And after a while, and a few more staggering dunes, she realized her hopelessness. After a while longer, she gave up and turned around and walked back home, following her own tracks and the elephant's. Back at the cabin, she used a damp washcloth and leftover bucket of brine to wash her feet and ankles and under her arms and between her legs. Then she got back into bed, trying to hold grief at bay. That wonderful saying from childhood and from the generation before mine's childhood, you know, have you seen the elephant? I just love that American idiom, and I couldn't help but think of it when I was working on this novel. A lot of different characters in the novel do indeed see the elephant.
Do you know where that saying came from?
I don't. I'm guessing it was like, you know, Barnum and Bailey in the big, you know, if you've been to the big city and seen the circus, you've seen everything, son. I don't know. That's my guess.
Okay.
Taking a big bite out of life, that kind of thing.
Rick Bass has published a bushel of books and received numerous literary awards for them. There's information about all that at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. And while you're there, why not sign up for a podcast and click on over to our Facebook page? Our Facebook fans have access to news about authors and recently published books, as well as links to book reviews, poetry, and archived programs. Thanks a lot for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a week filled with fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.